folks. Curtin was Western Australia's richest, most influential seat, the ultra-safe jewel in the WA Libs crown. Very, very late, in October 2021, a few Curtin voters formed Curtin Independent. They found Kate Chaney in late January, and somehow, someway, she scraped in with 51% on May 21. We last spoke during the campaign's frenetic last week and discussed how she led her volunteer team to build the plane while flying it. She said then she would not stand again if she lost. 2 years in. Hi again, Kate.
Hello, Margot. It is a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, you too. Right. What were your thoughts and feelings when you knew you'd won, and how did you create the new startup?
So I didn't know that I'd won for about 4 or 5 days after the election, and it was a really interesting time. I found that I felt pretty calm about it, actually. I felt like no matter what happens, we've run the campaign in a way that feels like it had integrity. I've done the very best that I could. I've given it everything. And either way, Curtin will not be considered a safe seat again. So it was a fairly calm, I think a lot of my team were feeling less calm about it. Part of me also was thinking, and if I don't win, I can go back to my nice life. And it wasn't all bad. But I did feel very excited when I did find out that I had the seat, and very honoured as well. And it is a huge honour to be elected as a representative, and I felt the responsibility of it. It's quite a weight as well, thinking this new community has formed based on radical trust, and now I have to actually live up to that trust and indeed do politics differently. So that's really the thinking that I've tried to carry through the last few years. And I've really tried to retain some of that naivety, because I think, you know, that coming in fresh from other careers, there are some parts of how politics works that seem really weird. And there's a danger that it becomes normalized and you think that that's just how it's done, and you forget that you can challenge it and things can change. So I've tried to really keep some of those thoughts and feelings from that first few weeks and not lose the novelty of them.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, like, you're a third generation federal politician, like, so naturally you'd feel the weight in that sense. And the responsibility of being the generation that left the Liberal Party and said it was wanted power without purpose now, and you're going to do something different. So I could just imagine, which also made me think, I remember when you first announced, you said, Fred told me not to do it. My dad told me not to do it. My family didn't want me to do it. How have they gone with what's happened?
Yeah, I mean, I've found certainly Uncle Fred has been a fantastic North Star through the last couple of years, and a really good voice of reason and reminder to focus on the big things, not sweat the small stuff, not take things personally. And that's been really useful. I mean, you say third generation and the weight of that, but to be honest, my grandfather died 20 years ago. My uncle Fred left politics when I was leaving high school. So even though there's that historical connection there, I didn't feel like I had any strong personal connection to the Liberal Party. So politics was really something quite new for me. And I did feel like I was coming into it as an outsider, even though there was that, you know, historical family connection.
So, when you decided to stand, you've got these volunteers, and we talked about it last time about how do I make this work. It's a second startup when you win, I guess, but in another way, it's a real transition, isn't it? You've got all these volunteers. I don't know. Did you have paid staff?
We had a small number of paid staff, but none of them had any political experience at all.
Wow. How exciting.
It felt like volunteers. But basically, we were paying them so they were able to drop whatever it was that they were previously doing and get on board. And, I mean, as you say, it was very much like a startup. And coming in as a new independent, there's no structure. Yeah. There's no how-to book. So, and I've changed industries and jobs a number of times before, and I think that was really useful. Because I started by the same way I would have started in changing any other job, and that is you are curious and humble about how much you don't know and ask lots of questions. So I went with Sarah Silbert, who'd been my campaign manager, and we went over and visited Helen Haynes in
Nangai. I remember that.
And Zali Steele.
No, Dai Lee, remember? Dai Lee, that was so... Oh, fabulous.
Well, it was great. I had a chat with a number of the new independents, but I spent extended time with Helen and Zali, who had previously done the job and already had an office set up. And so I approached it like any other problem, which was, how are we going to do this? And you literally start with I suppose we're going to need an IT system, and everything's completely brand new. And you go along and do a 3-hour orientation at the Commonwealth Parliamentary Office. And within 5 minutes, they were saying, don't sexually assault your staff. And I was thinking, well, okay, I think we've got that covered. Do we have an office? Is there a budget? It was really, really basic. But and it was hard because from day one, 100 emails a day were pouring in with people saying, what's your position on XYZ? And it could be very overwhelming, but we just pushed on through. And I was very lucky to continue some people from the campaign who then moved into electorate office roles, and then we recruited some more people and have had the most fantastic, passionate team, still none of whom have ever done this sort of work before, but all have brought expertise from different areas and a lot of enthusiasm. And really, we just sort of started from basic principles of how do we think we can best represent the electorate and best support people in their interactions with government.
So very early on, there was a crushing blow. I know Zali completely spat the dummy about Albo just slashing independent staff to nothing. Now, I know a couple of other members they've actually got people volunteering to staff and do community engagement. How have you managed the budget and managed to engage in what I'd have to say, reading your newsletters are really extensive, intensive, varied forms of community engagement and feedback and accountability.
So, and when the staffing cut announcement was made, I'd never done the job before, so I had no idea if that was a problem or not. I didn't feel comfortable asking my community to fund roles for me to do the job. So we've worked within the resourcing constraints that are provided, but it has meant that we've needed to tap into volunteer support more. And in some ways that has ensured that we are true to the community independent model. So, I can see it would definitely be really great to have a few more policy staff on the payroll. We make do with what we've got, and then we rely on the huge generosity of experts but also constituents to bring their professional skills in volunteer roles. So, for example, last year we did a Curtin Pathway to Net Zero project where we had 50 volunteers in 5 working groups looking at different areas of the decarbonisation journey ahead. And they met fortnightly for a year. And we had academics and engineers and policymakers and landscape gardeners and architects all bringing, and interested community members, all bringing their thoughts to those discussions and having civil discussion about what the priorities were, what the pathway was to decarbonisation. And I love that as a piece of community work, because you could have outsourced that to a consultant for a couple of $100,000, but it would not have had the depth and balance and buy-in as well that this piece of work
has. Buy-in.
Yeah.
Your community, by the sound of it, did it. It's so radical, so wonderful.
Well, and I love it, because this is now a mandate that I have from 50 deeply engaged volunteers in my community saying, here are the priority areas we want you to advocate for at a federal level. And it's also a wonderful, empowering piece for people to take to their local or state representatives as well, to say, what are you doing about our decarbonisation journey? So I feel like it not only gave me a mandate, it gave us a really positive vision, and it gave people a tool to advocate in all sorts of different contexts.
So did your group come up with a path to net zero in Curtin?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
I mean, and I say that it's in conceptual terms, but it says it has a snapshot of this is what our emissions currently are. It runs through the major themes of electricity, buildings, transport, greening and waste, and identifies in each of those areas what federal government needs to do, what state government needs to do, what local governments need to do. And we have 8 local governments within Curtin, and we actually do a comparison of how those 8 local governments are doing on those criteria. And it also then has actions that individuals can take, the easiest, the cheapest, the most impactful, and the political action. So people can take out of it, whatever they want. And it's also deeply referenced. So we have 12 pages of references. So any statement in there that talks about how we're going to get there and where we need to go, you can check where it's come from and check if you actually agree with it. And we really wanted it to have that intellectual rigour, but also be very accessible. I have a person on my team, Claire Gardner, who works a day and a half a week, but is really passionate about this, and facilitated these 5 working groups within that small envelope of her paid time, probably with a bit of volunteer time thrown in as well. And it just really shows even what one person can do in my team with the permission and the mandate and the freedom.
One thing I noticed very early, I think you were the pioneer on this. You invited the Labor Speaker of the House of Representatives over to Curtin and had a chat to him in a town hall, and people could ask whatever they like and find out how the Parliament worked. I mean, this is just – and I noticed later David Pocock invited Tony Burke to a town hall packed with unions and small business throwing questions at him. And there's an opening somehow that's happening. Have you sort of – is there a feeling of possibility in the Parliament in that way?
Look, it's wonderfully exciting, Margot. And I think one of the great things about coming to this as an outsider is we don't know what we can't do, so we just do it anyway. And that's been, it's very freeing. We think, what people think about this issue. Well, let's have a workshop and get them together and put in a Curtin submission. And so if I have an event on an issue, my preference is for there to be some output where rather than just saying, come and hear about this issue, I'll actually say, come and hear about this issue and tell me what you think. And then we'll take what you think and turn it into a product that feeds into our democratic processes. So a submission of some sort or a report that I can then take to a minister, so that there are these very real channels of communication between Canberra and my community and from my community to Canberra as well. And I think people, it's also great for people to hear different people's perspective and understand some of those trade-offs, it's a much richer conversation. If you go to a workshop and you sit at a table with people who have different views to you, and you actually have to decide what are our three priorities on housing, and talk about that with people who come from a different perspective, because we lose this richness of debate in our polarized tribal political discussions. And I'm really trying to improve the quality of the debate that we like have on these very complex issues.
It really is a startup. I mean, there's a thesis in it, isn't it? You got your PhD yet? Or you're still on your MBA?
I can't think about that, Margot. We try not to overthink it.
Ongoing continuous deliberative democracy in Curtin. Like, wow.
Yeah, and I mean, there are some fascinating models with deliberative democracy, like Citizens Assembly. And I'd love to see more of that. What we're trying to do is find the lo-fi version of that. What's the replicable models of informing people and then hearing what they think in a balanced, civil way that doesn't actually cost you, you know, 3 months of time and energy. And of course, there are always trade-offs. The shorter the event, the less deeply you can, give people the information they need to make informed decisions. But we're trying to explicitly trial these different models. And I think we've got a pretty good working model now, which is, open invitation, people come along, you share some information with them, you have some guiding questions, find ways to hear them, often using post-it notes and group work, and then some prioritisation processes that we then write up and share. And that model, I think, for a start, if you've only got one policy advisor, you need to work like that. I need my community to do the work. And it also is very much true to my role as a community independent, to be the channel for people to share their thoughts through, adding some value to it. It's obviously not just come and tell us what you think and I'll write it up without any, consideration, but moderation. But I think that there's some real value in that. The next challenge that I have not overcome yet is generally people who come to my events are more likely to be my supporters. Now, it's my job to represent the full electorate, including the almost half of it who didn't vote for me, didn't prefer me. And the challenge now is, how do you actually make sure you're hearing those voices as well? You can invite people to come to events, but you can't make them. And that's where the sortition model is really useful in a deliberative democracy environment, where people are randomly selected to be representative as opposed to the self-selection of those who choose to turn up.
Look, I'm going to deviate from my plan here, because that's a really good intro into, it's not as though the Libs are going to give up the duel without a fight, is it, Kate?
Sure.
And in February, two pretty high-profile guys fought it out, and was it February? Tom White was pre-selected. He's starting early. Now he's ex-president of the Young Libs. He was a government advisor under a former Liberal government. He got in on the ground when Uber started up in Perth. He went overseas and made his fortune and chief executive. He's come back. I listened to an interview he did on 6PR when he announced, and he said, right, I've given up my job. I am 12 months door knocking and listening, and my job is to, restore the reputation of the Liberal Party in WA, and convince people it's best being part of a team because you can make things happen. Now, tell me, is that serious competition, or are you just pretty relaxed and comfortable about it?
Oh, look, I think it's good for, you know, it's good for democracy, for things to be a genuine competition with people who are trying hard to present alternatives. And, I mean, to be honest, I find it's very weird coming into a world where it seems the norm is to do the job for 2 years and then spend a year talking about how you're going to do the job next time. So I'm still very much focused on doing the job this year. And there'll be an election at some point, and of course we're doing, you know, some planning about that. But really, I see my role as doing the best job I can now to represent the people of Curtin in what I find to be an exciting new way, and providing those opportunities for people to play an active role in our democracy. And you know, I welcome those discussions. I welcome the exchanges of ideas that we'll have as part of that campaign. Ultimately, if the people of Curtin decide that they would prefer to have a Liberal Party person representing them, there are plenty of other things I can go and do with my life to have an impact. But right now, I'm still excited about the option of this different way of doing politics, and giving people the option of having someone who's not beholden to vested interests or a party line, driven by the community, able to be a sensible centre voice that doesn't predictably vote yes or no depending on what the other guys are doing, and can work constructively with both sides of politics. So I think I've still got something to offer and want to keep presenting that. And, you know, we'll see how it goes next year. But in the meantime, it's really exciting doing it like this.
So as part of your role, I don't know quite how you did it, but you landed very important committee jobs on the Standing Committee, I think, on electoral matters and the committee examining gambling. And you seem to me to be making that your top two. Like each independent seems to have like Allegra is handling tax. Whoa! I mean, you know, you two granddaughters of Menzies ministers take on the big ones, don't you? Okay, so you're pushing very hard for a ban on online gaming ads, at which a unanimous recommendation, I think, from the committee, which is pretty good. And electoral matters, you've taken the bull by the horns, and what is it? What's it called? The trust and
Fair and Transparent Elections Bill, which we introduced last month.
Now, that is very, very important, and I was so proud that you actually did a Helen Haynes. Like, before the last election, she got every single crossbencher from far left to far right to back her in on her federal ICAC, and you've done the same for your bill. It's so telling that it's the big two saying, "Oh my God!" tell us more about that and how that's going.
Yeah, okay. I mean, the committee work I find a really interesting part of the role, because you do work with people from across the political spectrum on issues that are important. And so reviewing the 2022 federal election, being part of that committee has been fascinating. And from hearing all the evidence from a range of different witnesses, there were a lot of things that came out for me that weren't reflected in the majority report, and that I thought these are reforms that need to happen in our electoral system if we are actually going to retain the faith of the electorate. So that committee work then formed the basis of my first bill, the Restoring Trust Bill, that I introduced last August. And it was really important to me that that was developed with academics, with think tanks, with democracy organisations and the crossbench, because I saw this as being really the minimum requirement in terms of electoral reform. And there were some things over and above that people had different views on, but I picked 13 reforms that had really broad support around improving transparency, reducing financial influence, and leveling the playing field. And even, you know, it's interesting, you introduce a piece of legislation as a private member, and it's entirely performative. You know, there's no way that this bill will become law. It just doesn't work like that. But you draw a line in the sand, you put it into Parliament, you have the opportunity to talk about it and then also to talk about it in the media, and you say, here is an option that is actually possible. And it creates an expectation on government to then respond to that.
They must hate you for that. I mean, they've been promising their
bill. And that's my, you know, that's my job.
I reckon you, I thought my interpretation just reading the news is you went in early because they were putting it off.
So I introduced a bill in August, and then about a month ago, I introduced that came off the notice paper, and then about a month ago, I introduced a similar bill that had some slight changes in it, that had the broad support of the crossbench in both the lower house and the Senate, and so that was really saying to government, you could pass this legislation now.
No wonder they freaked out.
And well, because the big concern is that the two major parties do a deal on electoral reform. They say this is a good deal, but actually it has the effect of embedding the status quo. And, I mean, we don't let Coles and Woolies make the laws about supermarket competition, but somehow we do let the major political parties make the laws about how elections run. And so I think it's really important that there is community scrutiny on whatever electoral reform package the government introduces, so we understand what long-term impact it has. And 99.6% of Australians are not a member of a major political party, but we let the 0.4 govern how the rules work. And so I think it's really important that we have a level playing field so that we allow competition in our political sphere, just like we want competition in business because it keeps things healthy and innovating and adapting. And we don't want it to become sclerotic and you know, embedding the way it's always been, because things have to be able to evolve. So I think it's really important. It underpins every decision we make in Parliament, is underpinned by who's making the decision, how they got there, and who they might owe something to. So gambling reform, you mentioned, another committee that I sat on, we did the Social Policy and Legal Affairs Committee did an inquiry into gambling, online gambling. And as you said, it was pretty unusual to have unanimous recommendations, 31 of them, including a strong one that I really pushed for on that committee, that we phase out online gambling ads the way we have with tobacco. Now, such a strong report, it's almost a year later, government hasn't responded to that yet. And I can't help thinking that's got something to do with the fact that gambling companies are huge political donors. They've got a lot of power. Media companies will suffer a loss of revenue if they ban online gambling ads. They've got a lot of power, and the major parties are very scared of them. But we have to make sure that politicians are not driven by where the donor money is coming from. They're driven by what's in the public interest. And that's why I think that, you know, that role of holding government to account, shining a light on these issues so that governments and opposition, you know, have to actually account for their decision making is so important.
Okay, so I want to get on to a hard one. I noticed during the referendum campaign, you campaigned very strongly for yes. How did that work? Did because you ended up with about 600 or 700 volunteers at the last election, didn't you?
We did at the referendum. We had so the referendum, I think we had 700. Volunteers for the yes campaign.
So they came back. You kept the database and you said, would you like to help with this one? And the volunteers from the campaign came back?
Oh, look, there was some crossover. Okay. It wasn't the same group. It was set up differently. We recruited volunteers for the referendum campaign. So it certainly wasn't And I didn't, it's interesting, I didn't see it as a political issue. It's a social issue. And I found it very challenging because on most issues, I can really see both sides and I understand the complexity. It felt to me like there was a right answer and a wrong answer on the referendum. And my experience in Aboriginal affairs had really led me to believe that the only way we were going to close the gap was by actually empowering First Nations people to take a role in their own future. So it was a no-brainer to me, and I very much put it on the table and said, you know, this is part of who you get when you elect me. And I had been clear that I was supportive of that before the election. I think it was a sad outcome. My most optimistic interpretation of it is that Australians have a deep-seated sense of equality, and this threatened that sense of equality. And, you know, there's a difference between equality and equity, and I think there are plenty of good reasons why this was not a threat to equality, but I think that's how it was perceived. And so, you know, it was a difficult thing, but also I felt like you don't only fight for what you think is right when it's a winner. And it became pretty clear in the weeks before the referendum that it didn't have much of a chance.
Oh, gee, it was clear. But it was clear when Dutton said it's not bipartisan, surely. Really. I mean,
yeah, well, I think that was the nail in the coffin, really.
Like, you're talking to someone who lived through Mabo Week, the apology, the near double dissolution race election, and you saw it in the vote on the night. You know, there was the regional and rural there. They're just it's not a happening thing, is it?
Yeah, but that's right. But it felt really important to me that we kept pushing till the end for what I thought was right and what 800 people or 700, I can't remember what it was now, you know, in Curtin thought was right. And I was really happy that Curtin was one of the few electorates in WA. Well, I wasn't happy that it was one of the few electorates that voted yes, but I was certainly very happy that it did come out.
I think it was 51.
Yes.
Was it 51? But then also, it was pretty close.
Yeah, yeah.
About the same as your victory.
So it was pretty close. Yeah. It was very close to my election margin. Not necessarily the same people, but yeah, and you know. It still means about half the people in the electorate that I represent had a different view, and I now have to be very aware that there are lots of people who do want better outcomes for Aboriginal people and did not think that was the right way, and we have to build on the positives that came out of that, and you know, and find a way forward that's good for
maybe
the whole country.
Maybe think of that first interview I did with you, and you said, you know, the thing about being an independent is I don't have to betray my conscience. So it sounds like this is one where you didn't feel the need to consult and work out what the electorate want. This is one where, obviously, you know, it's generation. There's three generations of Cheneys that have been very, very committed to the cause of Aboriginal reconciliation.
Yeah, and that's probably, you know, that's probably in some ways a fair criticism. It would be a fair criticism of me to say I formed a position on that before consulting the community, but that was part of who I was and where I came from and my professional background before I ran. So I certainly didn't feel like I was tricking anyone in saying that that's what I stood for. But I think I would have found it quite difficult had Curtin had a majority no vote to reconcile that. But you know, it was that's the result, and we all have to live with it. And sometimes the thing that you think is right doesn't happen, and you still have to do what you think
is
right.
To me, you know, the big lesson, you know, talking to my relatives who, you know, never went to uni and all that and live all over Queensland, is that, you know, there is a, like, who voted yes? The rich metro seats and remote communities. Like, and there is a large swathe of Australia that really has no interest in this issue. And, like, my cousin, she didn't know that the 1901 Constitution didn't have exempted Aboriginal people from the census. She didn't know that the 67 referendum gave them, like, you know, it's a bubble in a way, and I really it's such a long journey, isn't it?
Yeah, and we've got learning to do, but, you know, and I think it's very difficult for First Nations people to now make sense of where to from here. And that is a we're all actually on the hook for that decision. That's not up to First Nations people to decide. We as a country have to decide where to from here. And I definitely think more learning has got to be a part of the path from here.
One of the things that struck me is that, you know, after the complete meltdown of Australia during the late 90s with the Hanson phenomenon and the two nations thing, it all sort of got civilized again and everyone sort of moved forward and et cetera. And it just seems to have opened up Aboriginal policy as a political issue again, which I don't know how the Liberals are going to play this time, but I hope it doesn't happen. I don't think it would, but it does worry me that it is now a contested area again. What do you think about that?
I agree. I think it is a worry, and it really leads into a broader worry about polarisation and tribal wars, really, you know, in the broader sense. And that's something that that I am very conscious of, that there is a lot of pressure to take a side, be part of a tribe, simplify things down to, you know, a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And most of the issues that we deal with are complex, and I'm really concerned about our ability to have nuanced discussions about complex issues and recognise that there can be multiple perspectives and that we need to actually find political solutions that can take into account multiple perspectives on things and find compromises, rather than there be a winning team and a losing team on every on every issue. And that's where I think the crossbench can play a really important role in working constructively with both sides and finding opportunities to improve legislation rather than just voting against it or, you know, voting for it, because everything can always be made better. And rather than having, you know, the pendulum swinging from one team getting everything it wants for 3 years and the other team getting everything it wants for 3 years, I think the crossbench can really have a moderating influence in the centre to take into account the interests of a larger proportion of Australians on more issues and find those compromises and those improvements and that nuance in our political debate that's not entirely based on culture wars and identifying with the tribe.
On that point, how are you treated by the respective parties in Parliament? Like, is there an opening? Is there respectful discussions happen and trying to work it out, or are you the enemy to the Libs and the, oh, we'll keep them sweet so she doesn't lose a seat to Labor? Like, is there a genuine opening up, do you think? Doesn't lose a seat to Liberal, I mean.
I would say it's nuanced. You know, again, there's not a simple answer to that, because the crossbench has a briefing with the government on legislation every sitting week, which is really useful. It's really good to know what legislation's coming, why it's coming, what the issues are in it. And I appreciate that. And I think that wasn't happening in the last parliament. So that's an improvement. And it is and generally I have pretty constructive engagement with ministers on issues. There's always an openness to further briefings and discussions about legislation, sometimes also to improvements to legislation. You're not always given credit for having come up with those improvements, but that's fine. If you're more interested in the outcome than jumping up and down.
Oh, how old-fashioned of you.
Right. The opposite. Yeah, that's right. From the opposition, it to be honest, it does feel like it's more of a game that's being played, and there's generally not as much interest from the opposition in getting the crossbench on side on a particular issue. Having us vote with the government is a way that the opposition can then say, see, we told you that, you know, they were secretly Labor stooges. So it doesn't always, it's not always driven by principle. Sometimes it's driven much more tactically. And then, for example, I'd put up an amendment to the recent tranche of IR legislation, which capped the additional entry powers being given to unions. Now, the Liberal Party voted against that amendment.
You would.
And you would think that the principle behind it they would be supportive of, but it was because it was proposed by me that it was not backed. And I find that very disappointing, that that the politics is seen as being more important than the policy. So wherever possible, I'm really keen to engage on the issues and on the content. I'm a whole lot less interested in the point scoring and the tactical game playing that you see.
Okay, last question. It must have gone through your mind when you knew you'd won that your entire family life would be completely upended. I mean, you've got three youngest children, haven't you? You've got a husband.
Yes, so they're teenagers.
Really? That makes it even more interesting, doesn't it? Because you've got a, you know, full-time barrister husband. So I assume your husband has become a martyr, and that, lucky you, and that your kids are like, and that you're in the air like hours and hours and hours, and you're never home. Like, what's happening? What's it been like, and how has your family adjusted?
Yeah, look, it's a pretty it's an unenviable lifestyle, I have to say. It's not great living in Western Australia and working half the time in Canberra. My kids, so now one of my kids has finished school and he's now at ANU fantastic. In Canberra. So I see him over there, which is good. So I'm like mourning the loss of my eldest who's moved out. But and then my other two describe me as being both an absent parent and a helicopter parent in turn. So I tell them, surely that means I'm averaging out to a great parent. They tell me it doesn't quite work like that. But it definitely is challenging. And my husband has been absolutely incredible. I had worked part-time for 17 years before that and really probably carried more of the mental load, although he was very much an active participant in parenting. And he just, I mean, pretty much from the day I said yes to running, I just handballed the mental load to him. And he's done an amazing job of delivering on that. You know, not always exactly how I would do it, but actually that's fine too. And the kids have, become more independent as a result of it. And, you know, they still have their issues just like they would if I was at home. But they, and I talked to them recently about the decision to run again.
Oh, you are running again, are you?
And the kids were, so I am running
How
again.
Cool yeah. Is that?
And the kids are supportive of that and my husband's supportive of it too. So I think that ultimately, you know, that was the test. And it, you know, it comes at a cost, but they've been really incredible, and I feel very lucky to have you know, supportive kids and husband and extended family who are great at you know, picking up the pieces when the wheels fall off, which inevitably they do from time to time.
As you know, I couldn't believe it when I saw you again after 2 years, and I just thought you must have been Botoxed or something. And you actually looked the same as when I interviewed you in the last week of the campaign, in that you're shining. I mean, for someone with so much academic and practical business consulting training to be able to say, okay, here's something new I'm going to create, it just sounds like it's a bit magical for you.
Well, it's been quite fun. I mean, it definitely has its moments. I think, you have to approach it with quite a lot of laughter as well, because you do find yourself in absurd situations, you know, rushing from one niche issue to another. And I'm, you know, I'm very lucky to have an excellent team of largely women, but who are passionate about it and, you know, very committed, and also bring levity to it. And I think we also have a constant a sense of appreciation of the incredible opportunity that we have to have an impact. And the responsibility of you know, representing our community. So it is a lot of fun. It's definitely the most demanding job I've ever done in my life, and I think, you know, that is how it should be.
Well, you're in your prime. You may as well do it now.
Well, that's right. But when you say you think I'm glowing, I'm pretty sure it's the lighting Zoom, Margot.
All right.
So, face to face, you might see the cracks appearing, but I do feel like it's a you know, it's an incredible opportunity to have, and I'm trying very hard to make the most of it every day, and just have approach it with optimism and hope that you know, that there are different ways of doing politics, and we can feel optimistic about our future. And and if people don't like the way we're doing it, then they can go back to the old way. But we want to really push the boundary on approaching it with a sense of grassroots community engagement, and really giving people access to their democracy.
Okay, one last thing. I just that you get Voices for Forest, which is a rural, regionally placed in the southwest of Western Australia, told them how you did it and said, but that's not going to work for you. Everyone's unique. And you said the start of the movement was Indi in 2013, and you really want to get more regional representation to go with Helen. And I thought that was so far-sighted, because the only way this works really in the end is if the city and the country can do the civil conversation and work out the thing. So congratulations for doing that. I mean, you're not starting a new party or anything, are you? You just
No, absolutely not. But I love. I mean, there are voices groups or equivalents in various different forms, in lots of different places. And I mean, I get a lot of email to my office saying, "How do you do it?" Or, you know, "I want to run. What should I do?" And so I connect people with the Community Independent Project, but I'm very happy to support groups who are in the early stages of saying, we think that there's a different way of doing it here, and we want to find a candidate. And so I'm very happy to share my own experience and our experience as a community of having been through that journey. I think it's a positive thing for democracy, and, you know, whether it's rural seats or outer suburban, or no matter where the seats are, I think that giving people permission to think that they can be represented based purely on the values and interests of their community, it's really at the heart of representative democracy. And the party structure is an overlay to the fundamental structure of our democracy, which is people elected to represent the values and interests of their communities. Now, that's now a radical idea, but it shouldn't be. And so I think giving communities permission to explore, you know, whether there is momentum to do things differently, is easy to do and so meaningful. And I think it should also have an impact on the major parties, who then have to pull their socks up a bit and realise that their voting record does actually need to reflect the values and interests of their community, and they should be accountable for that. So I think it can only do positive things for our democracy to have more people feeling engaged and a sense of agency and ownership in our
political system. And if you can talk politics face-to-face, that's the antidote to the social media crisis, isn't it?
Yeah, it really helps. And I think if you talk to someone face-to-face who has a different perspective to you, generally they won't be horrible to you as they will on social media. So understanding different perspectives, understanding what drives people, we need more of that. We need more civil political discourse, which is good for the whole country and really our only hope, I think.
All right. Well, thank you very much for giving me your time, and Power with Purpose suits you. Thanks a million, Kate.
Thanks so much, Margot. Really great to talk to you again.
Thank you for listening, and hope you enjoyed this No Fibs podcast. Until next time, goodbye.